This is What's It Like with Dr. Ken Tangen.
Hi, I'm Ken Tangen. This is episode 94 of What's It Like. My guest is Rob Walling, somewhere in California.
Fresno, California, Central Valley.
Fresno?
Yep.
No one is in Fresno.
Except for 500,000 people.
Everyone is from Fresno.
Yeah, that's what I hear. Although I just moved here about 3 years ago.
Why?
My wife is a psychologist, and she's a professor, and there were only so many jobs in California when we were moving back. So
you're not from Fresno. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in the Bay Area, the East Bay.
Oh, you're actually not that far away then.
That's right. Yeah, my family still lives there. It's about a two and a half hour drive to their place.
Did you come from a large family?
I'm the youngest of four kids. So I wouldn't say, I don't know, is that large? Maybe by today's standards, I think it is. I don't think it was in the 70s.
Did you have a favorite childhood possession?
I did. I had an operation when I was 4 years old. I had a hernia repaired, and my dad got me, both my parents, got me a little Garfield stuffed animal. And I had that with me for years, and I have no idea where it is now, but...
Who had the biggest influence on you when you were growing up?
Definitely, both of my parents did. My dad taught me the value of hard work, and he also taught all of us kids that you should have the desire to excel, to achieve. And it wasn't in a negative way. You know, I hear some parents who just overdrive their kids or drive them to insanity and make them, you know, have heart attacks or whatever when they get older. But it's like, it wasn't like that. It was really a partnership, I felt like, where it's like, let's achieve this together. In a way, he you know, could live by, may have been living vicariously through us a little bit. And then my mom taught me compassion, and she just taught me the human side of things. She was a very kind and gentle person. She still is. She's alive. But I'm just thinking back when I was 5 years old. Those are my memories of her.
What was your major challenge as a child?
I remember being scared a lot, having a lot of anxiety. Yeah. And I think, you know, I found out years later, we have anxiety. I don't know that it runs in the family, but I mean, there are anxiety disorders that, you know, in the DSM-4, the psychology manual of all the, you know, crazy things that can be wrong with you. And we have had several family members diagnosed with different anxiety disorders. And so I'm realizing that there is actually a somewhat of a genetic component to it. And I'm seeing it in my oldest son is 6, and he is just more nervous than, he's not super nervous, but he's on the nervous spectrum. He's definitely on the more nervous or more anxious side about things. And I can totally remember feeling that way being his age. So I think that was a struggle for me.
Are you ADD or ADHD?
I was not. I was very focused. School was very, it was easy for me. It was a very natural thing. I think book learning and reading and math and all of the stuff they teach you in school came very natural. And I loved reading. So by the time I was, I was reading by the time I was 4 or 5, and then I was reading chapter books in first and second grade. And I would read the Guinness Book of World Record cover to cover every year. And so I was that kid, right? I was the fun facts kid. And so by the time I was in second or third grade, I had a body of knowledge in my head that was way bigger than my actual kind of my social abilities, I'll put it. Like I was the kid who just had way more in his head than he could really handle. Too much for his own good, too smart for his own good maybe. But yeah, school did come. It felt very natural, and it was never a struggle.
More of a Big Bang Theory kind of life?
Yeah. Yeah, I would say that. I would definitely say that. I wasn't an outcast in that sense. I did know how to get along with people. And luckily, the school I went to was pretty small, and so I wasn't lost in the shuffle. I shudder to think if I was in second or third grade in a large public school, if I would have gotten lost in, basically, or just been exiled, you know, to the nerd group. But that never happened. Luckily, I think it probably should have.
Was high school better for you?
I'd say high school was worse. in terms of, because I went to a very small school and I started in kindergarten there. And so by the time, you know, you get older, you're basically an upperclassman by the time you're third, fourth, fifth grade. It went K through eight. And I knew everybody there. And so we all had this history. And in high school, we got dumped into a lot. That's when I did go to that larger public school. Now, what saved me is I actually backed off the academics. I backed off the reading and I played sports. And both my parents were proponents of that. And I, in retrospect, I'm not sure that I should have played football at all. I'm a tall, skinny, kind of nerdy guy, but it definitely made a difference in my level of acceptance. I think that kind of, you know, saved me. But even then, I never fit in like I wanted to. I always wanted to be part of the in crowd and be, you know, with the popular folks and stuff. Yeah, again, in retrospect, so foolish. You know, I'm just like, that was so fleeting, so stupid. I'm going to try to tell my kid not to. And I remember both my parents telling me not to worry about it, that it wouldn't matter. But it's hard to hear that when you're 15.
Yes.
So I think high school was definitely harder. And in college was much easier that, because then I went back to being who I really was.
Where did you go to college?
I went to UC Davis, University of California, Davis. Yep. And so it's an agricultural school, but it has a very good vet program and a very good engineering program. And I was in the electrical engineering and computer engineering program there.
How did you decide to go there?
I wanted to stay fairly close to home. And it's about a 90-minute drive from my parents' house. So I wanted to stay close to home, but also go to a good school. And I didn't know, when I was 18, I didn't know much. I was a little, I wouldn't go so far to say I was sheltered, but I was probably like the average 17, 18-year-old where I really didn't have a worldview beyond my nuclear family. And so I kind of asked my parents, what do you guys think? And they really, you know, especially my dad was like, well, I think you should stay close. I don't want you to go to Berkeley because Berkeley's crazy. You know, that was his worldview. You know, it's this scary city. I don't think you can handle it. And in retrospect, I think I would have had a great time, but would I have been more likely to maybe, you know, get caught up in drugs or something? Probably, if you go to Berkeley. I mean, it's compared to Davis, you know, it's just a different.
I don't know. One of my daughters went to Berkeley and she came out fine.
Yeah. And it's hard to know. So. But that's why I wound up there. I think I also, at that age, I'm not sure that I was, because growing up in the Bay Area, I should have applied to Stanford and Santa Clara and a bunch of other universities. I think, you know, we didn't have a ton of money, so I did feel a little weird about applying to private schools when there were perfectly good public schools available. I also think that I don't know that I could have handled the rejection at that point. I only applied to one school, applied to UC Davis, and I got in and I went. And that was perfectly fine.
Is that part of the anxiety thing?
Maybe it was a fear of failure at the time, I think. And
private schools often have the best scholarships, and parents pay, you know, just the same as the state schools.
I know. I didn't know that at the time. I know that now. But again, it's that smaller worldview, you know. I think that if the internet had been around, I would have been all over it and researched this stuff. But I didn't. I was so busy with my day-to-day life and sports and all that as a senior in high school. I remember just being like, I don't know, what should I do? And having like a few conversations and then just making the decision, saying, all right, I'm going to apply and get in. And again, what a crazy, like how monumental that decision is in your life. I'm shocked that I made it so flippantly, you know, and I'm not sure.
Don't you think we make our biggest decisions with the least amount of effort?
Yeah, I think sometimes we do.
So in college, you took computer science?
It was computer engineering, which is more... So computer science is more software, and computer engineering is more hardware-focused. And I did. I actually came in as an electrical engineering major. And again, my dad worked for an electrical contractor for years. He was a project manager. And so I figured I was going to go get an electrical engineering degree and then come out and work with him at that company. And I got a few years into it, and I didn't like it that much in terms of the education. And so I added the second major, essentially, the computer engineering, because I had been writing software. Boy, when I was about 8 years old, I got an Apple IIe, and I started writing code at that point. And it really fits with the way my mind works.
Nice and logical.
Yep, it is. It's the step-by-step, giving instructions, and it always does what you tell it. You know, it's just more, I don't know, it fits with who I am. So in college, I was like, it's only another, I think it was adding another quarter or two to get that second major, the computer engineering. And whereas CS would have been like another couple years. It's very different than electrical engineering. So I just added the CE degree and got the double major. It took me 5 years, but got out of there.
Well, that's not uncommon for universities either.
I know. I didn't feel too bad about it.
What did you do afterward?
I went and worked for the electrical contractor.
Ah, you were prophetic.
My dad, yeah. And I...
Father, son.
I mean, I've been talking about it since I was like 13. And I think that was a seed planted very much on purpose by my father and potentially my parents. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. And my brother... I worked there for years. He just left there. He worked there for 20 years, probably. I went and worked there for 18 months, and I didn't like it at all. I didn't like the work. I didn't like construction. I didn't really like a lot of the mentality of construction people in general. I mean, not to paint it with a broad brush, but it just didn't jive with me. I'm pretty logical, rational. I'm not into conflict. It's not that I can't deal with it, but I do not like it. And frankly, if you're managing construction projects, it is all about conflict. It is a lot of conflict. And pretty quickly, I knew that like all my friends were computer people. And it was rational. I was like, wait, why? I was teaching myself Perl and HTML at night. I'd go home, I'd go to the library, get books, come home from this construction job, teaching myself Perl and HTML. I'm living in the Bay Area in 1999, the dot-com boom. People with English degrees are getting $60,000, $70,000 jobs who've never written a line of code. And I have this history of my entire life doing this. And it occurred to me, it wasn't about the money. It was just about being happy, you know? I was like, why am I not writing code? This is insane. You know, why don't I go do that? And I applied for a job in Sacramento, of all places. It was so expensive in the Bay Area. I couldn't afford to live anywhere. I was living with my parents still. Because one bedroom apartments were like $2,000. It was crazy. And, you know, I was making 35-40K working at this construction firm, just couldn't afford it. So, I got married that year, 2000, and then got a job in Sacramento, working for basically it was a dot-com consulting firm. So they built websites for the dot-coms, and I learned to code there again. Yeah.
Well, so what exactly do you do?
Oh, I love it. This is such a great question. I get this at parties, and depending on the audience, if I have 5 seconds, I say, oh, I'm a software developer. But I don't write much code anymore. What I really do is, over the past 12 years, I've launched a number of websites and web applications. So if I have a little more time to explain it, I say I'm a software entrepreneur, or I'm a internet entrepreneur. Yeah. I'm a serial guy who's starting things up. I don't do consulting. I don't have a salary job. I work from my home, and I own about 8 or 9 different websites and web applications. And they're...
So you're pretty much unemployed and flighty.
You could say that. that could be one view of it, except for... Right, because wasn't being a consultant like code for unemployed in the 80s? Yeah.
Yes.
So I'm not that. I'm not a consultant, but I'm an entrepreneur. I mean, I'm a business owner. And I could say unemployed and flighty if my businesses weren't successful, you know. And I don't know how quite to define that, but
well, the culture hasn't quite changed, even though the business part has.
Yeah.
So there are people like you doing things that are difficult to explain to others.
That's right. And I think if the more internet savvy the audience is, the deeper you can go into explaining what it is. Like my application, I have invoicing software that people pay $300 for and they download it. And I have hundreds, or I may have just passed the 1,000th customer, you know, and I have an application that helps businesses rank higher in search engines. It's not a consulting business. It's a tool that helps them examine their keywords and does some other stuff. And so I have like 8 businesses like that, and they, I find that if the audience is fairly internet savvy, that I can start to go into some details of each of them, and that helps them decide or helps them understand more of what I do. But
did you start each of the businesses yourself?
I did not. I started some of them, and I don't even know how many, to be honest. I've acquired more than I've started. I've found that, especially with software, there are a lot of people who know how to write software, write pretty good software, but very few who know how to market software and find an audience and be able to make it profitable. And so what that means is there's a little bit of a glut of good software products, and every once in a while someone loses interest and wants to sell it, and they sell it a lot less expensive than it would cost me to build it myself or to hire someone to build it.
It becomes a good deal then.
It does. It does. And so I found this niche, I think, of, I mean, there are other people doing it, but I just stumbled into it. I didn't have a role model or anything, and I just kind of started acquiring more and more of them. I had a more than a dozen at one point. But yeah, so now whenever I see a good deal, I will buy it and rehab it, like, kind of like maybe a real estate developer, you know? You buy it and add a coat of paint and build an audience and, yeah, do that.
What's the best thing about your job?
I love the freedom. When I was consulting, I thought I was going to have freedom when I left salary job to become a consultant, because I figured, oh, you are your own boss and you can live anywhere you want, because I was working remotely. But I soon found that instead of having one boss, I basically had three or four bosses. They were my clients, and I had to do what they said or I lost them, and it was a challenge. And I didn't like having to be in communication between 9 and 5 and any of that stuff. So I love the freedom. I can live anywhere I want. I don't have to be online at any particular time. I spend a lot of time with my kids. I worked 2 days a week for about the first 10 months that my second son was born. And I could maintain all my businesses where they were. I didn't grow any of them, but I maintained them. And so the income kept coming in, and I hung out with him two or three days during the week and then the weekends. And that was a very, you know, obviously a formative time when you have a little guy like that. I'm very, very thankful to have the freedom, because I do not take that for granted at all. I know what it's like, and I know that most people don't have it.
Let me turn the question around. What's the worst thing about your job?
I wouldn't phrase it as worst. I may say the hardest. The hardest thing is, one, what's funny is you say about my job, I don't even feel like I have a job. I don't think of it as a job, you know, at all. I've always been really excited and kind of passionate about startups, entrepreneurship, and that's what I'm doing. Like, I'm living the dream that I always wanted to live, and it's very, I do wake up and kind of look like, wow, this is, you know, I'm sitting here in my home office overlooking a koi pond with a waterfall. I mean, it's just, I'm like, this is crazy. Is this really happening? You know, I never would have thought 5-6 years ago when I was in a cubicle that I would be here. I think the worst part or the hardest part is that there's no one above me to help to kind of ask for guidance or to make decisions for me. And if I don't make decisions, I don't go anywhere. And stagnation is hard. Like, it's I've had periods of kind of being almost depressed because I don't know what to do next, because I get bored. You know, a year or two into this, I got really bored with it. Because there's no, what are the new challenges? You have to create your own new challenges. There's no boss that's doing that for you. There's no career path. I'd say that's the hardest. I don't know that that's the worst. I wouldn't say worst. I don't know that there is a worst part of what I do. It's more of the biggest challenge is that you have to forge your own path, and that's sometimes that's pretty hard.
What type of person would be good at your job?
Someone who is a self-starter. Someone who has a lot of, I'd say ambition, but it's not ambition for a corporate ladder. It's ambition to build something. You really have to want to create things and be self-motivated.
If one wanted to, how would they get a job like yours?
I don't know anyone who's done it who hasn't, who's gotten a job like mine. It's more of, I don't know, most people stumble into it, I think. I think specifically what I do, where I have the portfolio of things, I think that may be kind of a one-off case. I don't know how many other people are doing that. I think people who just want to start a single, you know, website or web application, I think the best way to do it is to get a little bit of technical knowledge and a lot of marketing and just online savvy, and connect with other people who are doing the same thing. So there are communities online. I mean, I have a blog, softwarebyrob.com, where there's 20,000 subscribers, and it's people like me who are kind of trying to do this thing, you know, trying to gain freedom and build something that they're interested in, most of the time with web software, but it can be other things as well. And so that's the thing, is to find other like-minded people, and you know, it takes time for sure. It's not an overnight thing, but I think it's finding other like-minded people, because without that, you just don't have the support structure to keep you going.
Can anyone succeed in online business?
I wouldn't say anyone, but I don't think it's as hard as some people think. I don't think it's as easy as the late night infomercial people make it out, but I don't think it's as hard as a lot of people might have in their head. I do think there's a lot of hard work, there's a lot of time investment, but it's not as complicated maybe as people might think.
So what's step one? Get a product?
Step one, well, boy, it depends on where you're coming from. If you already have, step one is to basically learn the ropes of the internet, you know, kind of become web savvy and just learn how to, navigate the web and be intelligent about who's saying what and learning who to believe and who not to believe. I think once you're past that, then it's figuring out who's gone before you. Because I guess that's, at this point, there are some decent roadmaps to it. And if it's kind of finding someone whose approach jives with yours, with who you are. There are several different approaches, and depending on if you're analytical versus creative versus social, there are very different approaches to making it a go, with a startup or with an online business.
Do they differ in, they all have to have a product sometime.
They do, and I think that finding a product first is not the way to go in any of the approaches. It's about, like, if you're more social, then I think that you should use that, like build your network, build your connections, start a blog or a podcast, and build an audience first. And build it around something that you're interested in and that you think, you know, that some people may pay for it at some point, that you can add enough value that it's worth someone, you know, paying you a few bucks for a book or for an online course or something.
So you're more of the Google or copy blogger approach, build an audience and then figure out later something to sell?
Well, that's the social approach. I didn't do that. I actually built my businesses. I mean, I had a blog and everything, but I didn't monetize. I didn't make any money from the blog. I quit my job before I did that. And since then, I have written a book about my experiences, and that's, you know, done well. But I'm more analytical. And the more analytical side would be, say, go to the Google AdWords keyword tool and figure out how many people are searching for something, and then try to figure out how to get in the path of their searches. And whether that means actual search engine optimization or whether that means figuring out how to buy ads at a low enough cost, or how to work with affiliates, or there's several different ways to do it, but it's more of an analytical approach to marketing. It's almost like engineering marketing, you know, a lot of numbers and data and a funnel and all that. That's another way to do it. And then you find the market first, and then you either develop the product, or you may test that traffic stream just by investing a little bit of time or a little bit of money and seeing if it starts to pan out, and then you go and you either build the product or you have someone build it at that point. So that's what I did for three or four products. And then once I had the success, I had enough income that I could quit my job and quit consulting. Then I realized, oh, I also have this social part of me that I got bored and frankly kind of lonely. Like, I was running these businesses from home, and it was like, I don't really have a community. And so that's where I really invested in the blog, wrote the book. I have a conference I put on every year. I really got into the community aspect of this side of it, and that helps me stay sane. I also hope that it helps. I mean, my goal is to help other people, you know, also start their own businesses. And at the same time, it's worthwhile for me. I don't make a ton of money from it, but I make enough to justify the time. I spend more time on the community aspects of it than on any of my other businesses, frankly.
If there is such a thing, what's a typical day like for you?
Yeah, there is such a thing. I work Monday through Thursday, and I work, I typically wake up around 8 and get one of my kids off to first grade and one of my kids to daycare. And then I sit down at the computer, and I record a podcast one day a week. I do a lot of podcast interviews on different subjects, whether it's dealing with my products themselves or my experience as an entrepreneur. These days I'm working on my product Hittail, which is the SEO tool I talked about earlier. And when I say working on it, I have just a running list. I write a little bit of code, or I'm doing some marketing, or I'm working with a partner who's maybe wants to do a mailing. So just kind of marketing tasks. Email sucks up a lot of time, and I'm trying to figure out how to get around that. Still does. I have 5 virtual assistants who work with me in various degrees. So I touch base with a few of them and see what's going on. And then I quit typically around 4 p.m. and go, you know, pick up one or both of the kids. And that's the Monday through Thursday routine.
And you have the weekends off.
I do. Yeah. I work in the evenings. Sometimes I go in waves. I get pretty motivated at 8 or 9 o'clock at night. Kids are asleep. I get an idea for a blog post, and I will just sit there for 3-4 hours and do it. And that's technically work, but I was so excited I needed to write it, you know? Or I will come up with an idea for a podcast episode, and I'll just sit there and outline it. Or a marketing approach, and I'll sit there and crank out the whole thing. So I definitely work a few evenings a week. And frankly, I think about my business way, way, way more than I would admit to most people. I'm either consuming content that will help my businesses, or I am thinking about ways to do it. But I've been like that since I was 8 years old. It's kind of who I am.
Rob, everybody has to give themselves motivation occasionally. How do you give yourself a kick in the pants?
I have found a lot of value in mastermind groups, which are small groups of like-minded people. So I'm in 2 separate mastermind groups. One is an in-person group. It's just 2 other guys. And then the other one is via Skype. And they're, you know, there are other entrepreneurs throughout the, it's 2 other entrepreneurs in the U.S. And I meet with both of them every 2 weeks, and I try to stagger them because I really need that aspect. There's a bit of accountability. There's a bit of advice. I love giving advice and being kind of intimately connected with people and their businesses. And so that excites me to be invested in them. It also is helpful for me to get their feedback and their accountability and their thoughts and such. And that's probably the biggest ongoing source of motivation for me. I think the other one is my wife. I talk to her a lot about these things. She's a psychologist, so she's a good listener and is able to extract what you're saying, what you're really trying to say. She will feed that back to me, and it's like, oh, that is how I feel. You know, I just, so.
When you have to soothe yourself, how do you calm yourself down?
I listen to music. I'm very much into music, and I played in a couple of bands over the years. I haven't in, boy, it's been 7 or 8 years now, but music is a very big part of my life. And so I definitely, I have some, Elliott Smith is an old favorite. He's an acoustic, kind of a folk musician. So that's a big one. I also like a good glass of scotch. And that helps, definitely helps me calm down.
Is there an event in your life that has challenged you to the core?
Raising children? Absolutely. Has far pushed me far beyond my limits in many respects, more so than any business ever has.
Is there a principle or idea that has helped you through your challenges?
I think it's that, you know, it's hard not to sound cliche here. At my core, if I really look at it, the thing that has made me successful at anything I've done, whether it's businesses or challenges with children, is a a work ethic or perseverance, is the decision to come back every day and push it forward, push the needle a little bit and move it just a little bit. And it's amazing what that daily effort compounds into over the course of years.
If you were giving a commencement address for high school or college, giving your best advice, what would you say?
Oh, man. That's another one that's hard not to sound, because you have to be so general. That's funny. When I sat down to write my first book, I was going to write it about entrepreneurship. And the more I wrote, the more I hated the book I was writing, because it was so trite, because I had to generalize it. And by the end, my book is so focused. It's like laser focused. It's specifically for developers who want to start startups. I did that for a reason, because I don't know that I've, aside from Steve Jobs, his commencement at Stanford, I don't know that I've ever heard one that I've liked, because they're just too general and trite. And so I don't know that I have a specific advice off the top of my head. I think I would look back at stories. That's what he did, right? He took three stories and he linked them to how they helped him in his success. And then he ends it and he says, stay hungry, stay foolish. And that's his advice, is to stay hungry and stay foolish. And I think that's probably what I would tell people. I would look at tell them stories about probably perseverance, or how things that I never thought would link together in my life, and then tell them to go on and do their best work.
So tell me a story about perseverance or how things have linked together in your life.
I started launching online businesses in 1999, and I launched probably 7 of them, and they all completely failed. It wasn't until 2005 that I had any kind of success. And by success, I mean $1,000 a month in revenue. Nothing before that had come to that point. And so it's obviously a much longer story, but I told it in a Mixergy interview in painstaking detail. And the more I recount it, it's like, why did I do that? And I realized that it's who I am. Like, I had, Stephen King, he said that he was retiring, and a reporter said, "Oh, you're retiring. You're gonna stop writing." And he said, "No, I'm gonna stop publishing." The guy has to write, right? And I believe that at our DNA, we each have to do certain things. And I've kind of been built or designed to do these. I don't know that it's create businesses per se, but that is an outlet through which I've. Something I have to do. And so whether it failed or succeeded was not the point. I was disappointed with the failures, but after all those failures, having one success, was enough to keep me going. And then it wasn't, from 2005, it wasn't until 2008 or 2009 that I had enough money to quit my job, enough income to do it. And so that was another 4 years. And so, there's a lot, obviously there's a lot more depth to that story, but that'd probably be something I would relate to folks who are in 1999. It was a dot-com boom. I thought I was going to start a company and be rich in a year, and it was essentially 9 or 10 years later before I even had enough money to make just a standard living and quit my job. So that'd be definitely a lesson I would teach folks: be in it for the long term.
I want to thank Rob Walling for joining me today. Thanks, Rob.
I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
If you'd like to leave a comment, ask a question, or get more info, go to whatsitlike.info.